Hey guys, welcome to the Lunge and Lift podcast. Today we are covering three fitness fallacies, three things that are commonly understood incorrectly in our opinion. So we're going to talk about agonist and antagonist muscles. We're going to talk about mixed modal conditioning and its efficacy compared to single modality. And we're also going to talk about the mind-muscle connection and why it might not be as important as we're perhaps led to believe. But before we get into it, don't forget to click the link in the description box below to get your 7-day free trial to Rob's Strength Formula Program, which is your answer to the strength and muscle building equation. Also, thank you to thetrainingstimulus.com if you're interested in learning more about movement mechanics as a functional fitness professional or practitioner. Please check out the website and download your free guide to movement mechanics. And finally, a big thank you to ZAGsupplements.com, which is our favorite daily supplement, a liquid gel shot containing 29 vitamins, nootropics, and adaptogens, and it significantly improved our concentration, getting us dialed in for work and training. So please check out the website and use our discount code DISCLIFT20 to get 20% off your 2-week trial pack. All right, let's get into it.
Ash, how we feeling? You are out in Bali, living the life, and you've decided to cut out caffeine. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling pretty sluggish, actually. It's a bit later here than it is there. But 3 days, no coffee. And I thought I got away with it yesterday. I had a great day and probably trained a little bit too much. Didn't sleep quite as much as I'd hoped last night. So a little bit lower on the energy scale than I would typically be, but I'm optimistic that reducing my caffeine will be good for me long term.
How long are you looking to kind of cut it out for?
I'm going to go probably do at least a couple of weeks. We'll see how I get on with that. If there's anything super important I need to do, then I might have to tap out. But I think hopefully I'm at the trough. I've passed the trough now, so it should be easier. I definitely noticed I slept better the last couple of nights, having had no coffee. But we'll see. I think I really love coffee, so I definitely won't be cutting it out forever. But I do think that I might be able to get more better sleep quality and better rest by not constantly having coffees every single day.
Nice. I'm really looking forward to hearing about that. I remember doing 30 days of no caffeine myself and I felt amazing, really did. And it was mainly because I knew I was having too much. I was having monsters, coffees, I was doing the works and it wasn't a good place. And as soon as I gave it up for 30 days, again, rough for the first like 3 to 5 days, and then you kind of see the light on the other side, you kind of see it out, and then by like week 3, you start to feel like, okay, here we go. And like, I felt great. Yeah, well, it's like, you know, you felt, but by week 3, I think I started to really notice the difference. I was like, okay, I'm feeling like good. And like, I'm not then relying upon anything to give me energy and like a stimulant. And then when I started to reintroduce coffee back in, I remember it was a euphoria. It was like I had one, like a flat white, and like the session I had was insane and like it was great. And then one becomes two becomes three, and then you're back into the groove of caffeine. You're like, oh, here we go. So I mean you've got a perfect opportunity being out in Bali and like reduce all stresses and kind of like see how you can do. So I'd be really intrigued to kind of see how that goes, and I reckon the listeners also probably be quite curious to know about, you know, caffeine, because we are told how good it is for you and like there's so many performance benefits and stuff like that. But I think if you're constantly focusing on these performance benefits and you're not actually thinking about health metrics and thinking, okay, is it actually good for you? And you know, that if you're not using it as a performance enhancement, then do you really need it? It's like I did a workout today where I had no caffeine before. It was a massive endurance one. It's like two and a bit hours. And didn't have any caffeine, but I did have basically 1,000 calories of carbohydrates. So 20 grams every 15 minutes. And I felt great. Didn't need the toilet on my run. Didn't need anything. I felt great. So, you know, did I really? And I didn't. So I didn't have any caffeine at all. And my performance didn't lack at all. So I'm just like, I'll be curious. Really curious.
Yeah. I think that's it. Real energy versus perceived energy. I think that's the thing I'm trying to tune into.
Yeah, and I think it's important because I guess it's one of those fallacies, right? The things that we seem to all believe that we need caffeine because there's energy drinks, there's this, everything you need to have to kind of get the fire started to train. And you forget that training, you shouldn't have to be having things to train. It probably means you're doing too much. So then you're trying to now have to stimulate yourself to get going. So in regards to fitness fallacies, let's get on to today's three of fitness fallacies that we're going through. And today we've got antagonist muscles need to be the same strength. So that obviously means the front needs to be as strong as the back.
Pretty much, yeah. So when we're taught about anatomy and physiology, one of the common models for relating muscles to one another is you have an agonist and an antagonist. So classic examples would be bicep and tricep. They're on the opposite sides of the arm. The biceps are thought of as elbow flexors, the triceps as elbow extensors, and they work as a happy couple. You know, one contracts, the other relaxes, and vice versa. And we expand this concept to broader parts of the body. So we can think of like push muscles versus pull muscles. Think of chest and back as another opposing pair where, like you said, one set's on the front, one set's on the back, and they have roughly opposite functions. But roughly is the key word there in that they don't have directly opposing functions. So it is much more complex than just agonist and antagonist. There are multiple muscles operating on each of our joints, pulling in slightly different directions. So we can't think of it as simple as one muscle's on, the other muscle's off. So that's point number one. The second is that there's a notion that we should train each pattern equally. So we should train push and pull. We should always be looking to try and achieve some sort of balance in our strength in both directions. And I was reflecting on this recently and thinking how much bullshit that is, because there's so many examples in nature and in our human body where that's absolutely not the case. And I think to really illustrate this point, everyone knows the thing, well, hopefully everyone knows the thing about crocodile jaws, in that crocodile jaws are incredibly strong and they can crush bones, snap animals in half when they bite them. But the thing that everyone loves to say about crocodile jaws is that if you hold their mouths closed, they're incredibly weak on opening the jaw. And that's for a very good reason, is that it's an unloaded movement most of the time. When they're opening their mouth, there's no resistance other than maybe a bit of water. So they don't need to be strong in that direction. However, when they're closing the jaws, they need to be very strong because they need to, kill, attack, crush, prey. So our bodies have evolved to have certain movements that are incredibly strong and other movements that are just necessarily strong. They're just strong enough to get the job done. And we need to appreciate which muscles, which movements we actually want to be highly force generating in and which actually aren't that important. And there's probably a lot of examples we go through where we focus on strength ratios of push to pull, hinge to squat, to like hip flexor pull, tibant strength, all these things that we think need to be more proportionate. But these proportions are just totally arbitrary and I think overvalued at the moment.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I think it's understanding what your strength is needed for. So like, for instance, if you're needing to be an athlete for a particular sport, you're going to buy certain muscles and certain positions, which means things are going to obviously become a lot stronger than their counter size because they're just not needed. You look at a lot of like basketball players and you look at like their feet and how fucked up they are. Like, I remember seeing some posts recently, just seeing some of these like high performing athletes and like you see how fucked their feet are and you're like, they're some of the best, say, jumpers and runners and stuff like that. And you're like, fuck, but look at that. Look at that foot. So, like, do you need to have this, like, perfect moving foot to be able to run the fastest sprint possible? Clearly, like, with Usain Bolt, you look at his foot, it's a mess. But it's like, and then when it comes to, like, the muscles and, like, it's It's funny because for me, I like strength ratios because it's a nice way for me to kind of like segment things. Like I like to think, well, if I do one push, I can do a pull. If I'm creating an upper body session for myself, I like to have pretty much push to pull 1-to-1 just because it's I feel complete when I do that. But understanding that that's not essential for a, you know, to make sure I'm having a complete program doesn't then, isn't necessarily an issue for me, but it's because I understand that my metric for having a complete program is kind of a 1-to-1 push-pull ratio on most things because it makes me feel balanced.
Yeah. So just let me clarify a little bit further. In terms of strength ratios, I'm talking about things like people might compare their leg extension to their hamstring curl and say, oh, I can use 80 kilos on my leg extension, but I can only hamstring curl 30. That's a problem. And it's just totally pulled out their ass as to what the right ratio between knee flexion and extension should be. What we really care about is the output movement. So how good is your running? How powerful can you be when you're striking somebody in a martial art? Like, what are the actual movements that matter rather than these arbitrary, isolated strength ratios between certain muscles or certain joint actions, which somebody has said, you know, if your quad to hamstring strength is this ratio, then you're less likely to get injured. And I just challenge, I'd like to question how they've come up with that other than they've maybe spotted a trend with some people that they've worked with. But it's absolutely not a truth. You see so many people who have incredibly varied proportions, almost the same as your point there, and that you see people with all sorts of different foot shapes and types able to perform at a very high level. So that's clearly not the thing that makes you good at the thing. And I've seen so many athletes who are incredibly strong in a deadlift that are very quad dominant. So their like quad strength compared to their posterior chain strength would probably be a suboptimal ratio, but they're still pulling like high 200s pain-free. And, you know, are you going to tell them that they need to do some hamstring isolation work when you've got half their deadlift? Like, it's just, yeah. I think that's my bugbear with this one.
But yeah.
Probably an element of coffee withdrawal making me more.
That's why these three topics come out, because it's like, ah, fuck everything. It is interesting though, because it's like, it's funny because it just means that someone that is more of a quad dominant deadlifter has then found a way to perform the exercise that biases their strengths. It's the same as like, you know, like the fact of like me, I'm a lot more of a posterior strength athlete. Like I'm a lot more into my glutes and hamstrings, which is why a low bar squat and a conventional deadlift work really well for me. Like I feel very good in them. And an example is recently when I transitioned to sumo deadlift and high bar, if anything, there's more quads involved in both of those exercises. And I've loved the high bar because it's been a good challenge, but I resented every single sumo session I had. And it was just because it wasn't that I was then just shitty, but even though I was, it's like I'd recently done a 12-week cycle and at the end of it managed to hit 250. But like for me, it just, I never enjoyed it and it didn't feel good. And it's like the ratio for me, I actually had the thought process in my head. I was like, well, if I can deadlift 300, I'm going to be able to sumo deadlift like very close to that. And I realized that very soon that's not going to be the case. But it's interesting because like then those ratios, as you said there, someone having extremely strong quads but still having a very good deadlift, vice of me who probably has relatively weak quads compared to hamstrings and glutes, and my squat and my deadlift are completely fine as well. But I've just like you've said there with the crocodile jaws, it's like you adapt to what the task is at hand and what you actually need to do. And that's what's important, is if you understand what your metric to measure is, then that's what you need to then focus on, rather than worrying what other people say about this is what it should be. Because even though having like anecdotal like information of watching other, like going through all these, like, you know, what common trends that you see, as you mentioned there about like injuries, that can be a really good bit of data to know. But if you've got some own personal data that you know that you're fine doing it like this, then crack on. Don't stress too much. If you're constantly getting injured or things aren't going right, then maybe these type of, say, ratios or metrics might need to be looked at, because there might be a massive imbalance.
Yeah, exactly. If you're injured or you're plateauing, then obviously you want to look at what's going on. But I think you can easily spend a lot of time chasing these arbitrary ratios instead of just focusing on making progress. You almost just push the progress, and then you'll figure out if there are leaks at some point. But yeah, I think what you just said there, I think it's Goodhart's law, which is basically once the metric becomes the goal, it ceases to be a good metric. So if you're chasing a ratio between certain muscles, and that's what you're training for, the whole point of that ratio existing is because it supposedly helps you unlock absolute performance or reducing your injury likelihood. Those are the things that matter, not the ratio. So if you're chasing the ratio, you're actually losing sight of what really you're seeking.
Yeah, I mean, it's like sometimes in having a ratio, like looking at those stats could be an interesting task to do. But I think it's then the thing of dwelling on it. And as you said, then chasing this ratio that's been given by who with what study of people and all these, that's the things you have to remember. There's a lot of these studies are done on like untrained individuals and this and that, like they're already going to be fucked up. So don't worry about those studies. It's like they're good. They're a good starting point and good things to have in your toolbox to maybe think about, but to base a lot of things on can be an issue. So I love that, the Goodhart's law of the metric becomes the goal. Once the metric becomes the goal, it ceases to be a good metric, because it's like, I'm currently going through a fat loss phase myself, and I've not focused on the weight as being the metric for me to measure. I've said like, cool, I want to hit 96 kilos and then just see what happens. But as I'm coming down, I'm at like 97, like two. I'm like, I know once I hit 96, I'm not going to stop. And it's like, but I'm not, and I've not given myself a goal to kind of get to, because that isn't my measure. Now my measure is the performance of the task that I'm doing. So like my strength training, my fitness, that is my metric of, because that's my goal. Whereas like the fat loss phase is just like a nice little like check-in. So this is like when I said about like with the ratio, sometimes it's good to have this little bit of data just to see what's going on. And then maybe you can understand that if I then start underperforming, and then I see that, say, my weight loss has suddenly dropped a lot. Okay, then that's actually an interesting bit of information. I can say I might need to increase my calories and reduce how fast I'm losing this weight, because now my performance is getting hindered.
Yeah, that's it. Okay, number two was mixed modal conditioning being more effective than single modality conditioning. So I think this is something that's been popularized by functional fitness training and CrossFit, where you do Metcons and WODs and you jumble everything together, and you can get very tired very quickly by doing supersets of exercises with opposing muscle groups. And it's a lot of fun and it's very tiring, but in terms of getting you actually fitter, it has a lot of caveats to be aware of. And if you haven't listened to our episodes with Dr. Phil Price, where we talk about hybrid training and talk about mixing things up versus doing them on their own. And long story short is doing things individually is the fastest way to get good at those things. One of the major cons of doing mixed modal conditioning, so there's make it easier to visualize. If you do something like Miko's triangle, where you're using three different machines and rotating between them, that is a very different workout to doing the same EMOM on one machine. And basically one of the reasons why it's so different is that you're shifting the workload around your body. So you're actually changing the rest period for the working tissues compared to just repeating the same movement. So another reference to an old episode, when we had Sean Seal of Upside Strength on to talk about zone two, he went into the details of local tissue adaptations, where if you're doing the same modality for your conditioning, because essentially there's less of a break, those muscles, the cells in that area, have to work for the entire duration. That's what stimulates a lot of the adaptation. So if you're taking breaks, if you're shifting the workload to other parts of the body, that stimulus gets lost because those muscles actually get an effective break. So if you are looking for those local tissue adaptations to improve your fitness, you will be missing out on them compared to potentially a more boring session where you're just sat on one machine.
So you're telling me all this mixed modal zone 2 stuff I'm doing is all bullshit?
It's not bullshit. It's still definitely going to do something for you, but it's not going to do as much as if you were on one machine.
Yeah, and I think where I've been doing a lot more triathlon training at the moment is I've noticed exactly that, and it's how, for instance, when I'm training the skills in isolation, so I'm doing, say, intensity on my running, I'm doing intensity on my bike, I'm doing intensity with the skills of swimming, and then when I want to bring them together in like a brick session, I'm doing, say, a longer endurance piece into a shorter, say, steady run. So I'm not necessarily running at race pace post brick. It's more just getting the feeling of transitioning from one skill to the other. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't necessarily be doing, as like you mentioned earlier, like say 2K bike, 1K run, 2K bike, 1K run, because that's not going to help me. So it's rather than me actually getting better at the skill, which is essentially why I'm combining the exercises, so the mixed modal nature, because I'm trying to get better at the skill of transitioning, is when I'm trying to get better at the particular task to get better, I do the one thing. Just like when I did the powerlifting, I just did powerlifting with no other stimulation of cardio or anything, and I got good at powerlifting.
Yeah. You're not doing supersets from your heavy deadlift doubles and something. No. Like, right.
And I think, yeah, you know, when we had Casper Vintas on, and he was saying about, you know, resting more, not doing the supersets as much, focusing on just performing the task of the exercise better, yeah, you probably don't need to do as many exercises and you get a lot more out of it. You know, I took a lot from that podcast, and really, like, my sessions now I've got a lot less stuff in them. I still have a fair amount because it's and I still do supersets and stuff because that's how I like to, it's what I like to, what I enjoy. But the idea of not actually having as much and then say having like one key exercise as an accessory piece and really nailing that and then having a bigger rest period rather than doing, say, step ups and RDLs, for instance. So trying to be quads and hamstrings. So that's like the mixed modal nature. I can keep it as just, say, the RDLs and do them very good. And obviously, if you're doing this within the mixed modal conditioning, it's like you're talking about doing, say, like rowing and deadlifts, trying to get better at deadlifting. It's like, well, it's not really going to be the most optimal way at getting better at deadlifting. You will be getting better at the sport of mixing them together, so whether that's functional fitness, CrossFit, whatever, like you will be getting at the ability to do them both together. So that's when there's a case to obviously be mixing the modalities because you're trying to improve the skill, just like I mentioned with the brick sessions. But to do just mixed modal training compared to having some single modality training in, I think is a massive hole in people's and training methodology, because I understand it might be boring, but it's the boring stuff that makes a difference, right? Because it's the foundations of what helps you access the intensity.
Yeah, that, I think that's the key point. And that if you're trying to get good at any given movement, you've got to get to a stimulation threshold. So you've got to push yourself either through duration, through intensity, through speed, something like that, so that your body is challenged and then asked to adapt. And when you do a mixed modal session, you're adding in more variables, which could be the reason why you can't push harder. So say on your triathlon example is a great one, because triathlons are essentially one of the simplest mixed modal sports, right? There's three disciplines back to back, but they would never do these alternating interval sessions. And why is that? Like, if you're going from a bike into a run, if you're trying to get better at biking, but you're adding in the run, that run in between your bike intervals could be what stops you pushing hard enough to hit that stimulation threshold for the bike, because you're not on the bike for as long and you're not accumulating the same fatigue in the bike specific tissues because you're shunting blood around slightly by changing the modality. If it was better, triathletes would have been doing this for the longest time, but they haven't. And I think those endurance sports are pretty mature in terms of how sophisticated the training protocols are. There's very little variation in what programs look like because they've been pretty much dialed in to work with human physiology very well. And I think the mixed modal sports have a lot to learn from the way they approach things because they are so precise with how they go about creating physiological adaptation. So yeah, I think it's a big thumbs up for single modality training if that's what your priority is. Big caveat.
Yeah, I mean, when this gets me thinking though, and this is on not a slight tangent, but like when CrossFit obviously was introduced, so back in 2010, wasn't it, roughly? Yeah, 2005, 2010, whenever it was.
Yeah, early 2000s, yeah.
Early 2000s, I don't remember, but essentially, you want to think, so that when we start thinking about like trying to get people in the gym, trying to keep people stimulated, trying to keep people wanting to keep moving, like the endurance stuff, as you said, has been going on for donkeys. You know, people have been doing long runs, endurance bikes, endurance triathlons, essentially. Like they've been around for a long time. So training like this is incredibly monotonous. And it takes a certain type of person to sit on a bike. When you say using an Ironman as example, you have to do say 180K, I think it is, or something like that, right? So it's a fair amount of time you're on that bike. You're talking about 4 to 5+ hours biking. So obviously in training, you're not necessarily going to be doing say 4 or 5 hours often, but getting close to the race, you probably will be trying to accumulate a very similar amount of volume, but then you wouldn't run the marathon afterwards. You'd be probably running like say 5 to 10K afterwards, because again, you're not looking at the skill of running a marathon after biking. You're looking at the skill of transitioning from one to the other and building up volume and then practicing the skill of running in its own individual sessions. But then when you think about CrossFit and like the high intensity nature, when people are not like, just imagine you come into a class and you're right, okay, we're going to do bike intervals today, like 5 minutes on, 5 minutes off, 10 rounds. You're like, sorry, what? Obviously that class is going over 60 minutes, but do you know what I mean? It's like, it just wouldn't go down well for most people because they're like, this is not what I'm paying you to teach me to do, even though they'd probably get an amazing stimulus from that session. It's just not enough of a stimulus for their head to stay checked in.
Yeah, that's the key. So you know what, CrossFit.com actually does program workouts like that. I saw not too long ago, they had like 8x400 meter run, and that was the workout of the day. And it's, you know, it's a great session. And people would get more out of that than alternating run and row, but people might enjoy the alternation more because of exactly that, the novelty, the variety. And let's be clear, we're not saying that there's anything wrong with that or it's bad for you or anything to that nature. Just saying that they are overvalued in terms of how much they benefit your fitness compared to the single modality alternative. If you're looking to actually improve your fitness as effectively and as efficiently as possible, doing more single modality stuff will do that.
Yeah. It's like essentially like if you're trying to get good at toes to bar, so using CrossFit as the example, like if you want to get good at toes to bar, you're going to take them into isolation. You're going to say do an EMOM there. So you're going to perform a certain amount of reps and try and obviously build up your threshold off toes to bar in a period of time. Then when you want to start getting a little bit more sport specific, you might start thinking, okay, cool, now I'm going to pair it maybe with like a low aerobic piece. Then you might pair it with, say, like something that's maybe an antagonist to the toes to bar. So like say deadlifts or something like that. So then you start to think, okay, cool, I'm now getting more specific to the sport. But if you want to get better at toes to bar, you wouldn't be doing it mixed with the deadlift from the start. You'd be saying, right, I'm going to get better, so I'm going to do the single modality first, improve the skill, improve my threshold, and then when I start to increase intensity by adding in other modalities like some low aerobic work to kind of get the heart rate up, get you understanding then what it feels like to be under fatigue, and then we start adding in then the specificity of the sport, then you can start to see where breakdown happens and see, cool, actually, has what I've done in my EMOMs worked? And have I built up a better threshold for, say, toes to bar?
Yeah, exactly. So let's just dig into that one a little bit more. If the goal is to get the biggest unbroken set of toes to bar, adding in different movements isn't going to be as effective as just training toes to bar. If you think about your max effort set of toes to bar, all the fatigue is from doing toes to bar previous to the last rep that you fail on. So by using different types of pre-fatigue, you're not giving as an effective stimulus as just doing relentless sets of toes to bar, because your body is, one, getting better at the skill, like you said, by doing more reps of the movement that itself that matters, but also you give 100% replicating fatigue, because toes to bar fatigue is the fatigue that will build up when you're doing a max unbroken set. And you can apply the same logic to any movement pattern, that the more specific you can be, the better that movement pattern will get.
Yeah, love it. And number three, every exercise needs a mind-muscle connection. Love this one. So for me, I'm a big fan of the mind-muscle connection, and I know that's the bias of my bodybuilding background and how much I enjoy getting that feeling. However, what something I saw recently, and I fully agreed with it, it was like, you don't necessarily need a mind-muscle connection, you just need to be in a better position. So you just need to work that exercise better and it will be doing its job, rather than you worrying about, am I squeezing my biceps efficiently? It's like, no, just put it in the right position and do the task at hand. And for me, I was like, that is great if you know what position to put yourself into. And what I mean by this is, if you're, say, this isn't your thing, like you're not necessarily a fitness professional and you're just someone that trains and you're just like a bit more of like a weekend warrior type trainer, like, you know, you just turn up, do your sessions. Getting a mind-muscle connection is a nice way to say, okay, I am in the right position. So if you're, say, focusing on, say, something like bodybuilding and stuff. Problem obviously then stems is then when you start thinking outside of bodybuilding and you start thinking about more big movements, say like a back squat, front squat, deadlift, shouldn't be looking for a mind muscle connection here.
Yeah, exactly. So exactly what you just said there, in that the mind muscle connection as a concept comes from bodybuilding, in that in bodybuilding we're looking to isolate and grow a specific muscle or muscle group. So we want that muscle group to do as much, if not all, of the work in a given exercise, so that we can take it close to or to failure to stimulate that specific muscle to grow. And this is where the notion of like sculpting a body comes from, in that you look at your physique and you see what muscle needs to come up to have better aesthetics, better proportions, and you want to work that muscle, not its neighboring muscles, because they're potentially already bigger or in a different ratio to what will look good on stage. But that flies in the face of functional movement, which is just about task completion. So if you are looking to throw something, if you're looking to pick something heavy up, it's not about isolating a muscle. It's the opposite. It's you're trying to get the body working together as a aligned system where everything is doing its proportional work. So when you're squatting, the perfect scenario is that all the lower leg, your whole body, all the muscles in your body are working well, and you get proportional distribution of workload across all the muscles in your lower body, so that they work in harmony and move in the most efficient way possible. What we don't want when you're squatting is only your quads to do the work, because you're missing out on a huge amount of recruitment from other big, strong muscles. You can use adductors, even hamstrings, glutes. They can all contribute to a squat. So when we have this mind-muscle connection, trying to target specific muscles to do complex multi-joint movements, we actually become less efficient in those patterns by down-regulating contribution from lesser prioritized muscles like your adductors, for example. We don't want to consciously try to control which muscles do what work. The subconscious is phenomenal at figuring that out. Like you just said, if you put the body in the right position, the right muscles have to fire, because the joints move and take the ends of the muscles away from each other. They, at some point, they have no option but to contract. So with the right setup, anyone can recruit any muscle, and we just need to find that setup for the person to train that movement effectively.
Yeah, it's like something you said pre-recording that I liked, and it was you talking about people say they can't feel their glutes, and it's like they'll do a full session, like I didn't, like say I'll do all the Romanians, the hip thrusts, I'll do all the glute exercises, and I just couldn't feel them. I was squeezing as hard as I could, and then they just thought, clearly I didn't work them properly, or I got weak glutes. And then the next day they're fucked, they're like, whoa, my they're sore. And that just means you might have a poor mind muscle connection, but it doesn't mean they're not doing the task at hand, because at the end of the day, if you're able to execute the lift of choice that you're doing, your body's going to be doing it properly. You're not going to have zero glutes work. It's just not going to happen, because they're having to stretch, they're having to contract, they're having to do the task that you're executing anyway. So the mind muscle connection can get massively over focused on when it's not a necessary thing to focus on. So like Ash was saying, and like at the start, with bodybuilding, it's very different. Like you're trying to use, say, an adductor machine to work those adductors. So you're actively trying to isolate them, essentially, to grow that muscle. But for most people that aren't bodybuilders, but like might have some bodybuilding in their day-to-day, in their training, it can be quite a good thing to have, because it kind of tells you, okay, cool, I'm kind of working a good position. It can be quite a nice endeavor to chase. But to make sure that you say, right, these are my bodybuilding style exercises in my session. This is my strength or big functional piece that I want to do, where I want the whole body to work as one, and I'm not thinking, all I'm thinking about is the execution of the lift. I'm saying, right, squat or pick it up, like whatever it is, and making sure it's a subconscious thing rather than you focusing on glutes, hamstrings, toe.
Yeah, exactly. And again, just to be clear, we're not saying there's never a place for it, and feeling a muscle do work can be really useful information, especially if you're trying to change technique, that you want to get away from certain muscles and into certain muscles, then it is a useful data point for sure. But the statement is, not every exercise needs a mind-muscle connection. There are plenty of situations where you shouldn't be thinking, you shouldn't be getting into the muscle. You should just be doing the task and focusing on the technique and skill of the movement. There's also another class of exercise generally around mobilizations and restoring joint motion, where we aren't looking to activate muscles directly. It can be a downstream consequence, but things like getting your spine to articulate better, so improving your side bend or improving your rotation, we're not looking to train a certain muscle. We're looking to actually restore the ability for the bones to move about each other better. And that often will be mid-range for muscles. So because we're not taking your muscle to any significant length, it's not going to feel much stretch. And because we're not looking to work very hard, we're just trying to actually move into a new range of motion, there isn't going to be much work done either. So a lot of people doing these sorts of exercises, like, I can't, it doesn't feel like it's doing anything, because it's not a significant muscular contraction like traditional gym exercises, but that's still okay. It still achieves a lot for our body. Another example of this is foot pronation drills, where we're getting the bones and the feet to articulate better, to spread the foot closer to the floor. A lot of muscles will be stimulated by a pronation, but we're not looking for any one in particular. So we're not necessarily making it a quad exercise, a glute exercise. They will get stimulated from good pronation, but in looking for that mind-muscle connection, you actually can block a good pronation because you are tensing those muscles. You're looking for tension and contraction from them, which actually stops the pronation from happening because it requires relaxation rather than tension. So just, I want to, make everyone aware that sometimes it's great to have a mind-muscle connection, especially in bodybuilding, but a lot of the time it's better to focus on the task you're achieving, or and there are a potential other class of exercises where the stimulus is actually more relaxation and bone articulation rather than just stimulating a muscle.
Yeah, I mean, for me, when I think about like certain movement mechanics that I would say prescribed by yourself, or like when I say couldn't feel, say, a certain part of my glute, I've always known, like squatting, deadlifting, never had any issues. So that my glutes have been doing everything they need to do, but maybe then other joints, other muscles have been working harder than they need to because other ones aren't getting involved. So that's like where I then start to feel, say, my glute med start to pick up a lot more stress, because then I did some specific glute med drills to kind of get that activation, get that firing. So then the mind muscle connection actually then become very apparent. But then when you still put me back into the function of a squat, I don't have that feeling anymore. I'm not then feeling the mind muscle connection. I'm just feeling myself performing the lift as I should be. And that was the way I felt a really good, like, a good visualization of the mind-muscle connection when it's needed and when it's not. So I was using the mind-muscle connection to essentially get something, say, activated and switched on. So then when I put it into its full movement and it's not in a form of isolation, that I then didn't feel it anymore because it was just doing what it was supposed to do. And that if I was feeling it in that, I'm doing something very, very wrong.
Yeah, exactly. So you can feel the muscle activate in what we might call a micro load in a movement mechanics set or sort of pyramid set, maybe. In building up to do a squat, you might fire up your glute med with some integrated isolation work, is what we'd call it. But then exactly what you say, once you go back into the main movement, the glute med is not the prime mover in a squat, but by it doing more, everything else will feel a bit better for you because of your mechanics. So that's a nice example.
Yeah, I mean, something that I remember from the mentorship, and that was that you say is bones move joints. Bones move, joints feel, and muscles react. And I always like that, because it's a very clear, like, if you picture yourself and you look at, say, the skeleton as a whole, and just say, like, you break it down, the skeleton first, that's what's moving. Then you got all the joints on top of that. And then you got all the muscles on top of that. And it's when you start to break it in that kind of way, you start to realize that, cool, okay, maybe the mind-muscle connection isn't what I'm after. I'm actually trying to get the bones to move in the right plane and the right motion to get the joints to work, to then get the muscles to obviously react accordingly. So,
exactly, spot on. So the skeleton is really in charge of muscle activation. So when bones move apart, that dictates which muscles lengthen, which dictates which muscles activate. So exactly like you say, if we focus on the bone movement as the priority, then the muscles will take care of themselves. We don't need to try to consciously override really complex movement patterns when our subconscious and anatomy will take care of it for us.
Beautiful. So I guess a couple of takeaways from today is to not stress too much about both directions of movements being equally strong, as they're just not meant to be, as we've seen from like the nature and also just when you think about using like a squat pattern or something like that, you don't want them to be working the same amount as well, because then obviously you wouldn't be moving. So yeah, there's a lot of issues there. So just understand that we want things to be in the ratios that they are for you. And if you've got some issues coming up, then there might be something that needs to be addressed. But if you're moving well and things are kind of going in the right direction, stuff like that, you're probably sweet. Obviously, with the mixed modal stuff, we were definitely not bashing upon any mixed modal fitness. But what we were saying is, if you're looking to improve fitness in a particular skill, whether it's a skill or a certain, say, aerobic piece, then doing that in isolation, doing some monostructural work, will really help you improve that skill because of the localized fatigue of that skill, rather than then kind of giving it essentially a rest and going and doing something else for a period of time. Obviously, that takes into consideration getting better at the skill of, say, performing a functional fitness workout. But when you're trying to get better at a particular skill, keep it in its monostructural setting. And I guess the stop, always looking for a muscle when you're doing functional movements. So if you do the exercise properly and let the subconscious learn, it will do it well. So basically, just move properly and you'll be sweet and everything will be doing its necessary job. So I hope you enjoyed today's episode, guys. As always, if you did, we would love it for you to share the episodes on social media. Don't forget to tag us at lunge.lift. As always, if you did enjoy it, we would love for you to head over to like Apple Podcasts and give us a review there. Or if you're on YouTube, don't forget to leave us a subscribe and maybe a little like on the video and help those YouTube algorithms find us. Also, as always, a huge thank you to our show sponsors, WhitFitness.com, for all your WHIT kit. Head over and use code discount code LL15 and get yourself 15% off your purchase. And thank you to Hytro, our blood flow restriction apparel sponsor, and use code LL20 for 20% off. All right, we'll see you guys next week.
Thanks, guys.